From Alaska to Hawaii, New Jersey to Wyoming, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, the proposed PRO Act threatens to force many Americans working as independent contractors out of work. Leah Palagashvili from the Mercatus Center at George Mason University is here to explain. Republicans ended the often corrupt practice of congressional earmarks back in the 1990s. But the earmark system has returned. Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth has the real story. Democrats are once again making a play to eliminate the Senate filibuster. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine explores the impact with James Wallner from the R Street Institute. And income inequality and wealth inequality are not the same. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, explains the difference on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. During this time of record high unemployment caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, many workers have become independent contractors, turning to the gig economy to make ends meet. The proposed PRO Act, now before Congress, could take away that safety net. Leah Palagashvili is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. She's here to explain how the PRO Act will impact workers. Leah, welcome to American Radio Journal. Leah, the PRO Act is before Congress. Tell us what this act involves.
One aspect of the PRO Act would force most independent contractors in the U.S. to become employees. It's quite similar to what we saw with California's AB 5 just last year. And both the PRO Act and California's AB 5 are able to do this because they create a stricter definition of an independent contractor, which makes it more difficult for individuals to work as independent contractors.
What do you mean by the term independent contractor? Because I suspect there may be a lot of people who, in fact, are independent contractors, but may not even know they fall into that category.
Independent contractors are individuals who are sometimes freelancers, or they contract out with different organizations for their services. They're sometimes referred to as self-employed individuals. So if you make money or any source of income from outside of a regular employment job, you would be considered an independent contractor.
Can you give us a couple of examples?
An electrician who's a contractor would be an independent contractor. Graphic design freelancers, freelance musicians and writers, workers on Uber and DoorDash as the gig economy platform workers. Those are all types of individuals who are considered independent contractors. By the way, also nannies and online sellers on platforms such as Etsy.com, those are all independent contractors.
And this PRO Act would then require them to become employees rather than independent contractors?
Yes, the Act would force most independent contractors to become employees because of the way they define what it would mean to be an independent contractor with an organization. So it would make it more difficult for individuals to be independent contractors as defined by the law.
And what sort of impact, Leah, would that have on folks who are currently part of this independent contracting or gig economy?
Unfortunately, we would probably see job losses, because what the economics research suggests is that this rule would create more harm than good for a majority of independent contractors, because a majority of them would neither become employees nor be able to keep their current jobs as independent contractors. So in other words, most independent contractors would lose their jobs completely as a consequence of the PRO Act. And we actually saw exactly this happen in response to California's AB 5. Just last year, 200 Vox Media freelance writers lost their jobs as freelancers with Vox. And Vox cited that compliance with California AB 5 made it impossible to continue working with these writers. That was a New York Times profile of what happened with Vox. The LA Times did a heartbreaking profile of the creative community members who suffered because of California's AB 5. And These are small theater companies, music festivals, and all kinds of different types of artists and creatives. And actually, partly because of what happened, this impact that it had on the creative community, especially the musicians and writers, it led to California granting over 100 occupations as an exemption to California's AB 5. And it was in the news about how the entire music industry lobbied for this because they talked about how it crushed their industry. As we know, a majority of individuals working in the music industry are freelancers. And by the way, just wanted to point out that Uber released their analysis of what a nationwide reclassification would mean for Uber's business model specifically. And they said they would only be able to hire a quarter of their current drivers as full-time employees with Uber. So that means 75% of those currently driving with Uber may lose their jobs entirely, which means they would be neither employees of Uber nor can continue to be independent drivers with Uber.
Another group of individuals who would be significantly impacted here, Leah, are women who really need the flexibility of being an independent contractor. So can you talk for a minute or so about how this will harm women in the workplace?
There's been a lot of research about women as independent workers, even before the rise of gig economy platforms. And as you pointed out, the reason that women may want to work as independent contractors or become independent workers is because it gives them more flexibility that they might need. For some women, they are also the primary caregivers, so they're otherwise maybe unable to take on traditional employment. And so when we think about independent contractors or gig economy, we have the conception of Uber in our minds, and a majority of the drivers for Uber are men. But if you take out the transportation sector entirely, we actually see that women comprise a greater share of the independent workforce than do men. And I want to just give you an example. If you take something like the Etsy platform, year after year, 86% or greater of their online sellers are all women. And again, if you look at a platform like Care.com, it's another gig economy platform for nannies, personal care aides, dog walkers, 95% of workers on that platform are women. And so I just wanted to highlight that when we're talking about reclassifying this employment category of independent contractors to employees, we need to also be open and understand how this might impact women who might choose to work as independent workers precisely because they're unable to take on traditional employment. So challenges to the legal classification of independent contractors could actually disproportionately hinder women's participation in the labor force.
We have been talking with Leah Palagashvili, who is a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, about the proposed PRO Act and the negative impact that it would have on independent contracting and the gig economy. Leah, tell us a little bit about Mercatus and where can folks go to read your writings?
Well, thank you so much for having me on the show. You can go to www.mercatus.org to learn more about Mercatus Center and to find my writings. The Mercatus Center is a university-based research center at George Mason University.
Again, we have been talking with Leah Palakashvili, a senior research fellow at the Mercatus Center, of course, located at George Mason University. Leah, thank you for taking time to be with us.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth, he keeps an eye on Capitol Hill for us, and there is much still going on, even in the wake of passage of that $1.9 trillion so-called economic stimulus bill. Scott, welcome to American Radio Journal.
Thanks for having me back, Loman.
Let's talk first about our old nemesis, earmarks. And earmarks are something that Republicans had made go away. Now they're making a resurgence. So tell our listeners what earmarks are and what took place this past week.
The late, great Tom Coburn used to call earmarks the gateway drug to federal spending. And Senator Jim DeMint from South Carolina used to refer to earmarks as the engine in a really, really long train. It's a small part of the federal spending that drags the entire large omnibus or infrastructure package or any spending bill, really, that is going to be loaded up with thousands of pages of legislation they try to reward members that are voting for the legislation with pork projects in their own congressional district. And so when House Republicans won the majority in 2010, they swore off earmarks and banned them from their conference rules. And no earmarks have really gone through Congress, at least through congressional requests. We might have a couple of things that are plugged in here or there that ultimately have made it through in these gigantic packages. But the overall trend of earmarking has not been a part of federal spending for a decade. And it was really the first step toward draining the swamp and ending this culture of corruption in federal spending. We know that some members of Congress are prone to be bribed by various lobbyists or special interest groups that are looking to have extraneous provisions inserted into legislation, and earmarks are a big part of that. And so what happened now is Republicans and Democrats are adopting various reforms that will increase the level of transparency on who's requesting the earmark and whether it's supported by a community. But I think even if you have to change the name to a community supported project, it still quacks like a duck, and then it's a duck, so it's an earmark. And obviously the currency of corruption, the culture of corruption in Washington, just a couple months after President Trump's out of office, the swamp begins to fill.
Speaking of filling the swamp, there also is a maneuver that is taking place to allow expenditure of that $1.9 trillion, quote, stimulus package that I referred to earlier. It's a little bit in the tall weeds, but tell us what sort of maneuver is taking place relative to spending all that money.
So think about it this way. Congress always has budgetary discipline and authorization on how much money it can spend. And when there's an emergency like the coronavirus pandemic or a major earthquake or tornadoes or flooding or forest fires, they always load up these emergency supplemental appropriation bills. And in each of those emergency supplemental bills, there's always a statutory waiver for the PAYGO requirements, the requirements that if you exceed your authorized spending levels, you have an automatic sequestration at the end of the year. So as Joe Biden and Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer jammed through that $1.9 trillion Biden stimulus plan without any Republican support, now they're coming back to Republicans and saying, hey, we know we just went on this huge spending spree of $1.9 trillion, but you know what? We need you to join us and waive that budgetary discipline by waiving statutory PAYGO for that level of spending. And obviously, this is very, very poor fiscal discipline. And I think it's a partisan effort by the Democrats that are trying to warn Republicans, unless you go along with this, the across-the-board spending will also impact priorities that you care about. It won't just claw back the money that we pass through the Biden stimulus.
Well, certainly you are correct, Scott. The swamp is getting deeper here just a couple of months into the Joe Biden administration. We are, however, looking forward to 2022. The Senate, of course, divided 50-50 between Republicans and Democrats and their independent allies. Looking at 2022, we've had a number of Republican senators announce their retirement, the latest coming from Missouri. Can you fill us in on that?
A couple of weeks ago, Roy Blunt, who is in the Republican leadership, announced that he was not going to seek re-election. And so that just creates another big, expensive, open Senate seat in a 50-50 Senate when we know that, you know, really the balance of the majority can come down to who wins these tight elections. And I think Missouri is a fairly competitive state. It's been a red state recently, but it wasn't too long ago that Claire McCaskill held the seat. Josh Hawley obviously defeated her in 2018. But we've got big open races that I think will be competitive for Republicans to retain in Ohio, where the Club for Growth PAC has already endorsed Josh Mandel. We've also got a big open race down in Alabama following the retirement announcement of Richard Shelby, who's been a real long-term senator, was once a Democrat, Southern Democrat, and flipped parties to the Republicans in the early 90s. Then we've also got an open race in North Carolina because Richard Burr is not seeking re-election. So those are three big swing states. When you also add in your state of Pennsylvania, Pat Toomey is not seeking re-election either.
Well, the 2022 races are already getting interesting, and on a future edition of this program, we'll talk about Republican opportunities in the House of Representatives as well. But for now, we've been talking with Scott Parkinson from the Club for Growth. And Scott, tell us a little bit about the club.
Yeah, the Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of Washington, D.C. If your listeners want to check us out, our website is clubforgrowth.org. And our Twitter handle is @ClubForGrowth with the number 4.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, again, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The filibuster is a longstanding tradition in the U.S. Senate. Now, Democrats are trying to do away with the rule. It would be a major change, as Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine learns from James Wallner of the R Street Institute.
With Democrats enjoying the slimmest possible majority in the Senate, of course, the Senate evenly divided between 50 Democrats and 50 Republicans, but Democrats have the tie-breaking vote in the form of Vice President Kamala Harris. There's been increased attention this year on the filibuster and on the potential that Senate Democrats may exercise the so-called nuclear option to end the filibuster for legislation. And that's what we're going to take a look at today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. My guest today is James Wallner. He's a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, and he is also the author of a piece about the filibuster that you can find this week at Reason.com. And he joins us now to talk about this somewhat convoluted issue. James, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
James, I guess the first thing, I think most people probably know what the filibuster is, but quickly just define it for us. This is the mechanism that allows the minority to kind of hold up a vote on legislation in the Senate unless there's 60 votes to pass it.
That's correct. The filibuster is really just the opportunity to speak for whatever reason, for good or bad, to obstruct or to achieve your goals in the Senate.
And there's been some talk, obviously, this is really a conversation that goes back years now, talk about the so-called nuclear option of killing the filibuster. The Senate could actually do that, unless I'm mistaken, with a simple majority vote, right? It's kind of one of those weird things that this is a supermajority mechanism, but you could kill it with a majority vote. Why hasn't it been killed yet? Like, what's the political mechanism that keeps the filibuster in place?
Well, first, you're absolutely correct. We call it the nuclear option, but it's basically the ability of a simple majority to eliminate the filibuster, to change the Senate's rules, is rooted in Article 1, Section 5, Clause 2 of the Constitution, which gives majorities in the House and Senate the authority to determine how they want to conduct their proceedings. With that authority, the Senate has developed and adopted standing rules of procedure, one of which is the cloture rule, Rule 22, that states that you need a supermajority to end debate on a piece of legislation. And the majority can change that rule with a simple majority vote under the Constitution. However, in doing so, it will be violating its current written rules, which state that you have to have a two-thirds majority, even higher than the typical 60, to change the Senate rules with regard to the filibuster. And in my opinion, regardless of what's being filibustered, it's never a good idea for majorities to use their power to simply break the rules and change the rules, even though they may have, technically speaking, the ability to do so. Briefly, with regard to why majorities haven't done this in the past, first of all, they have. Majorities have done this on numerous occasions. Most recently, the Senate Democrats used the nuclear option to change the filibuster for most presidential nominations. Senate Republicans used it again in 2017 for Supreme Court nominations, and they did it again in 2019 to shorten the amount of time after you invoke cloture on all nominations. And so majorities have done this, but they don't really do it with regard to the legislative filibuster. And there's lots of reasons, but one of the reasons why is that the minority will typically retaliate if it's and use the Senate's rules that are on the books to otherwise obstruct the Senate's agenda. So it makes it really difficult to do things in the Senate without cooperation.
We're talking with James Wallner. He's a senior fellow at the R Street Institute, chatting about the interesting and convoluted political dynamics that maintain and may eventually kill the filibuster in the U.S. Senate. James, just a couple of minutes left here. Obviously, the reason why this is a big point of discussion right now is the fact that the Senate is 50-50 split. Democrats have nominal control because Vice President Kamala Harris is the tie-breaking vote. But the issue here, or at least the issue that we've seen so far in the early days of the Biden administration, is that Democrats, it's not so much Republican obstructionism that is blocking Democrats from doing some of the things they want to do, like, say, a $15 national minimum wage, but it's actually some of those 50 Democrats disagreeing and breaking away, and nuking the filibuster won't change that.
In my opinion, what's really responsible for the delay in the Senate's business, both under Republican control and also under Democratic control, is not the filibuster. It's how minorities majorities are using their power to manage the Senate. Right now, the Senate majorities want to get unanimous consent to set up votes. So they ask for the minority's permission if they can schedule a vote. And when you ask for someone's permission, they have a right to say no. That's not the filibuster. They're asking unanimous consent. They're not actually forcing these minorities to filibuster. And there are plenty of Senate rules that make it very difficult to filibuster, in addition to the physical realities of trying to stand on your feet and speak for a very long time, and the emotional realities, the psychological limitations on this. So the filibuster isn't the issue in my book. It's the way that the majority runs the Senate. They can use the two-speech rule, Rule 19. It's a talking filibuster. Joe Biden had an interview where he said, we should make them talk. Well, why aren't you making them talk? That's my question. The Senate rules don't need to be changed for you to, if you're a Senate majority leader like Schumer, to force minorities to actually talk. And so the question that everyone should be asking isn't why the filibuster is a problem. It's why the majority isn't making the minority filibuster in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's actually a reform that I would really support. Like, make the senators do the work. If you want to use the filibuster, hey, actually use it. Stand up there and talk for 24 hours if that's what it takes. Last thing before we let you go, James, are there any other reforms to the Senate rules you'd like to see? Not necessarily as a R versus D thing, but just as a good governance type of reform, something that would actually help the Senate function more effectively.
Look, I don't believe that the Senate rules need to be changed. They're perfectly fine as they are. They just need to be used. But you're absolutely right. There's no effort. There's no willingness to expend effort to achieve your goals in the Senate. And as long as that is the case, no amount of reforms are ultimately going to make the Senate productive.
Well, we are out of time for today, so we will have to leave it there. That is James Wallner from the R Street Institute. James, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, that is James Wallner. He is a senior fellow at the R Street Institute. You can find his work there at rstreet.org. And if you head on over to reason.com, you can find the piece that he has written for us this week about the political dynamics of the filibuster. Find that again at reason.com. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. Catch me right back here next week on another edition of American Radio Journal.
As the dramatic tilt towards socialist policies gains steam in Washington, D.C., the issue of income inequality is headed for the front burner. Colonel Frank Ryan, USMC retired, talks about it on this American Radio Journal commentary.
The concept of taxing wealth is gaining ground, especially since Elizabeth Warren and Senator Bernie Sanders first proposed the idea in the mid-2010 period. Presently, both senators are calling for a wealth tax of 2% annual tax on wealth greater than $50 million and rising to 3% for wealth over $1 billion. Even President Biden is suggesting such a tax makes sense to balance the overspending in our government. In prior years, there had been a great deal of discussion about wealth inequality in the United States. In fact, a video depicting the crisis paints a picture of a nation in which differences of opinion among Americans between the perceived distribution of wealth versus the desired distribution of wealth versus the reality of the distribution of wealth becomes painfully obvious. It's interesting to note that throughout the whole video, the distribution of wealth problem is solved by attacking the income disparity and not the wealth disparity. The fallacy of attempting to solve a wealth inequality problem through income redistribution is due to sheer complexity of the tax code, which makes the discussion for the average person mind-numbing at best. Initially, I found it strange that extremely wealthy people seemed to favor tax policies encouraging wealth distribution. It seemed illogical that the super rich would favor wealth redistribution since it would adversely affect them. Warren Buffett, for one, has often criticized the tax code, saying that he is not paying the same tax rate as his secretary. This seemingly selfless sacrifice of these very ardent supporters of wealth redistribution almost impressed me. Almost, that is, until you dissect the reality of their arguments. In reality, I've never seen such disingenuous comments about wealth inequity as I've seen with the liberal media and the super wealthy. The super wealthy liberals are playing the mainstream media for a fool. But now the concept of a wealth tax may come back to bite the very wealthy people who are demanding solving wealth inequality with an income tax. The arguments that the mainstream media use about wealth inequity almost always revolve around income redistribution because the mainstream media does not understand our own tax code. Let me say this as clearly as I can. Perceived wealth inequity will not be solved by income redistribution. Income redistribution efforts will actually make wealth inequity worse because income is taxed and wealth is not, making it harder for workers to acquire wealth. Some of the programs that reinforce perceived wealth inequity include the tax code, the charitable deduction for appreciated securities, and the ability to borrow against appreciated assets. Due to the sizable fortune that Warren Buffett has, for example, he is also able to significantly limit his earned income because he is able to pledge, if he so desires, his Berkshire Hathaway stock on any loans that he might decide to take rather than take additional taxable income. The advantage of this for someone like a Warren Buffett is that he would be able to enjoy the fruits of the gains on his stock without having to pay tax on those gains until he created a taxable event. These tax code issues are minor issues to almost every American except the super wealthy. When the super wealthy supports income redistribution, it's crucial that you understand that they support income redistribution because it leaves their wealth intact. Income is taxable, wealth is not. The difficulty with all of this analysis is that it's complicated. It's easier to explain to people that it is income that is creating the problem of inequity versus wealth. As a result of this difficulty, the super wealthy are extraordinarily willing to jump on the income redistribution bandwagon because it quite candidly does not affect them. In fact, encouraging income redistribution helps protect their status as the wealthiest of all. Now that it is President Biden, the progressive love for the Wall Street donor base may have just vanished. Wealth tax proposals are gaining ground, and those wealthy people who championed wealth inequality through income redistribution may have just had the tables turned. But the fallacy of the wealth tax should not be lost on anyone either. To pay for such taxes, assets may have to be sold to pay the tax, forcing growing businesses to liquidate to pay the tax. Warren Buffett, for example, may pay over $2 billion per year in taxes under a wealth tax, but the question of how he raises the $2 billion should not be lost on anyone either. I certainly have no major desire to take care of the financial needs of billionaires, but it is disingenuous at best to not be concerned at all about the impact on the economy of a wealth tax. A substantially better approach to the federal deficit is to demand government efficiency, change rules on carried interest, change stepped-up basis rules for estates while eliminating estate taxes altogether, and finally evaluate the constitutional role of government in a free society rather than the explosive growth of a bureaucratic machine that we now have. For the American Radio Journal, this is Frank Ryan.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including WWON-FM in Waynesboro, Tennessee, WBUQ-FM in Bloomsburg, Pennsylvania, along with KCIL-FM in Houma, Louisiana. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal. lighting the brush fires of freedom.